I think your head, you are filled of several different approaches to yoga, not just aspects of it. I'm sure you have been introduced to the definitions of yoga. The literal meaning and the metaphorical meaning, the figurative meaning and the interpretive meaning and all that. There are two important texts. Am I not? My voice is not carrying that far. Another second, come in. Close. There are two important texts which are considered almost textbooks to yoga. One is called the Yoga Sutras, and the other, the Bhagavad Gita. In the Bhagavad Gita, there is a beautiful expression which makes it clear why we are supposed to practice yoga. Why does one practice yoga at all? Is it in order to attain something? Do we want to become something? For instance, if I am sick, do I practice yoga in order to become well? If you use the word "I am sick" in a similar sense to, for instance, "I am a man," you cannot get rid of that sickness. I am a man, I cannot become something else. I cannot become an elephant, for instance, whatever yoga I practice. It is not in that sense, because if I become something, it is possible for me to re-become the previous thing, as it happens to most of us. We are sick physically, and we practice yoga in order to overcome that sickness, in order to get well. And as soon as you get well, what do you want to do? Become sick again. This is the danger of having a goal. Leave that alone. But am I sick, or is sickness something that has crept into me? That is, the idea is this: that which has a beginning must have an end. That which does not have a beginning does not also end. If I had been born blind, no yoga that I practice is going to create eyesight. Why? That is how I am made. That is how the body is made. But if I was born well, and suddenly some sort of eye problem developed, that can be got rid of. This is what yoga teaches us. Why does one practice yoga? Atma Shuddhaye, for self-purification. Merely purify yourself. There are other definitions of yoga in the Bhagavad Gita. We are taking just one thing. Atma Shuddhaye. For self-purification. Taken in this light, you understand what is meant by practicing yoga in order to gain health or regain health. You are born healthy and there was some interference. The interference began, had a beginning, and therefore this interference can come to an end. That's possible. That which has a beginning can have an end. The toxicity of the body had a beginning and the toxicity can come to an end. The health of the body had no beginning. It was born with you. And that will continue as long as the body is there. As long as the body is there, you can remain as healthy as you were when you were born. Provided you are able to remove the disturbances caused to it. In Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, there is a very delightful example given. Kshetrikavate. That is, this process is very much like farming. The farmer does not produce one fruit. God bless him. He cannot make one fruit. He cannot make a single leaf of grass grow, single blade of grass grow. What does he do? There is potency in the seed, there is fertility in the soil, but there are some obstructing elements. First of all, these two have to come together. And the potency in the seed should be helped to manifest itself by the removal of all the obstructions, and that's all the farmer does. He brings about those conditions which are conducive to the revelation of this potency, to the germination of this potency. That which is not in you cannot be brought about by the practice of yoga. This is axiomatic. Yoga is not bringing something which is not already in you. Yoga is not achieving something which you are not already. If there is such an achievement, it will come to an end. Yes? Atma Shuddhaye, for self-purification. And this purification takes place at numerous levels. At numerous levels. And it is not enough that this purification be effected on one level only. And there is filth accumulating at other levels. The whole place will stink. If in your house one room is clean and all the others are stinking, it is not a very healthy state of affairs. It may look healthy for some time. I know of some people, I'm not referring only to people whom I met in Australia, but elsewhere too, who are very fond of makeup and perfume. Heavy makeup, oh my gosh, and perfumed. It's excellent for friends, acquaintances, sorry, not friends, casual acquaintances. It's excellent because we sit at that distance, and I look at you, you are marvelous, and from here you smell glorious. But get a little closer, the person stinks. I once sat near a so-called holy man who was an inveterate smoker, I believe, and also probably meat eater. And it happened to be his birthday. So we had to share the same sofa. And every time he turned and wanted to talk to me, I said, my God, quite a lot of my karma is being worked out. And yet, he appeared to be very nice, very well dressed, very decently dressed, and looked radiant. That is what happens when you develop one aspect of your personality and even bring about what is called health or self-purification in that aspect, which is normally the body. Why is it so? Because we have the confirmed conviction that I am the body. I have the confirmed conviction that I am the body, and therefore I am trying to purify the body all the time. The body, the body, the body, the body. The body must be exercised and health food, organic vegetables. I am not making fun of all this, they are all good. Organic vegetables and organic soaps, your skin must be beautiful, your hair must be glorious and soft and lovely, and how to keep your eyes healthy and your nose healthy and your... All right, very good, excellent. You look marvelous, you look glorious, you look radiant, you look attractive. You look attractive, and so I am attracted to you. But when I come close to you, I am repelled. Because there are other things. It's not only the bad breath. But the breath flows out of you, not only through your nostrils and the mouth as breath, but as speech, as talk. That's also breathing. So bad breath does not only mean bad breath in the usual sense, but foul language, foul, filthy expressions, filthy talk. Talk that is unhealthy, negative, unhealthy. So you may be physically attractive, and I come close to you, and immediately I am repelled. One must look into it. Because it is not, we are not the physical body only. I am not saying I am not the physical body. But even if you accept that the physical body is one aspect of yourself, you are not only the physical body. There is a life force in it. There is a mind in it. And there may be something higher than that. Something which is called the mind on a superficial level. So, if you want to purify yourself, you must purify the whole thing. Not merely concern yourself with the toxicity of the body or detoxification of the body, but detoxify your life force. Detoxify your mind. You know, it was Mr. Howard who once said, which is marvelous, he said, "Swami, these people are making such a lot of hoo-ha about pollution. I'm not so scared of the pollution problem, because the first pollutant that our most ancient ancestors learned to live with was oxygen." This is according to the mythical or Darwinian theory, that once upon a time all of us were fish. And fish was taking oxygen from water. Then when a few of them were thrown onto the, jumped off, leapt off, and fell on the ground, they died. Then, by an internal struggle, or God's grace, or by the grace of Mother Nature, we closed all those gills and developed lungs, and we learned to breathe oxygen straight, not through the water. So he said, Mr. Howard said, that if it is possible for us to live with pollution, and it may even be that in a couple of thousands of years, or maybe more, we can breathe only polluted air. Clean air will kill us. I had an example of that, illustration of that. I was in New Zealand. I had come to New Zealand from Los Angeles. And I had a very terrible throat problem. I was coughing and carrying on. When someone asked me in New Zealand, I told him that I got it from the smog and the polluted air of Los Angeles. I didn't realize that almost close to my elbow was an elderly lady who had come from Los Angeles, was born and brought up in Los Angeles. "Pollution in Los Angeles? What do you mean? It's perfect there." I said, "Thank you, sorry. I didn't know that you were here." "Oh, it's perfect. I love it there." "All right. So what can you do?" She's used to that. I was wondering how she carried on in the yoga center in New Zealand, because it's very clean air there. She wouldn't be able to breathe. So one can get used to all this. It is not the physical pollution that should really frighten us. It is the psychological pollution that is even more dangerous. How does one deal with that? Is the question that the yogi asks himself. The body can be cleaned. The body can be made healthy, or restored to health is a better word, because health is already there. And so, the pollutant, physical pollutant, which cause ill health, can be cleaned out by the practice of some yoga asanas, eating clean food, pure food, organic food and all that. But that is not all. Even there, even in the case of getting rid of physical toxins, one comes across problems. Because when the toxins are released from the body, when you, by the practice of yoga, asanas and pranayama, the toxins are immediately thrown into the bloodstream. And they can also give you some problem. Some aches and pains suddenly might develop till the whole thing is eliminated and cleared out through proper dieting, fasting and all that. Then when the body's health has been restored, then the yogi pays attention to the life principle, life force. It is the life force that links, one must be very careful here, it is the life force that links the physical molecules, the cells that comprise the body, with the intelligence within it. This is not a sanction for the egoistic notion, I am the body. It's a different problem. The life force merely makes the cells, the insentient cells of the body, sentient. The inert cells of the body, living substance. That's all the prana does. And the prana circulates throughout the body through what they call nadis. I don't know, probably you have even got a chart with all the nadis mapped out. I was reading some yoga texts which describe these nadis. Many of them mention a number, 72,000. I don't know why. If I had been the author of the text, I would not introduce such a round figure. I would have said 73,499. That sounds like a supermarket pricing, price tag, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Everything is 499, 699. So I would have said 7,000, whatever it is, 73,499. So to make it exact. And if you challenge me, I would say, come on, you count and prove me wrong. That's easy. Anyhow, they have mentioned 72,000. 72,000 is a colossal enough number to baffle you. But the other day I picked up another text which had some figure like, I forgot now, 346,000 nadis. Even in a small body like this, 346,000 nadis. Are nadis electric wires which have been built in a sort of solid state affair? Are, what are these nadis? The word nadi comes from the Sanskrit root nadi gatau, movement. So a nadi is a movement. You may visualize it as existent, of course, but it is really a movement. Just as light waves are, just as radio waves are in this room, it's a movement, it flows. And the flow itself is the nadi. If the flow is healthy, uninterrupted, then the prana functions beautifully. Then the body-mind connection is healthy. If there is some disturbance there, you get into psycho or somatic or psychosomatic illnesses. It can be three. I don't entirely subscribe to the theory that all illnesses are psychosomatic, just as I don't believe that all illnesses are merely physical. There are physical ailments, there are psychological ailments, there are psychosomatic ailments, all three. If these nadis do not function properly, there is some disturbance there. And you develop one or the other of these three problems. One must know how to purify the nadis. That is not very easy. It is not as easy as going to the health food shop and buying organic stuff, because one has to understand life itself. How has life come into being? How does life live here? And what promotes life and what endangers it? Many of these are not entirely in our hands. Some are. Anyhow. So there are, it's a very serious problem. I suppose if one day somebody really found the key to this problem of purification of the life force, there need be no death at all. Just for your information, in Hindu mythology, we are told that there are quite a few so-called immortals. But they say even they die eventually, even though they are called immortals. Only one personality whose name occurs in a scripture called Yoga Vasishtha is considered to be really immortal. And he is known as Kakabhushundi, pictured as a crow. This crow is sitting somewhere without being wiped away even when the cosmic dissolution takes place. And when he was asked, what is the secret of your longevity, he describes a type of pranayama which I don't think it's very easy to even understand. Why? Because the prana by its subtlety really appears to be a movement in intelligence. It is not a movement in physical spatial vacuum, but it is a movement in intelligence. And so, anyone who studies the movement of prana immediately finds himself in the study of intelligence, whose superficial layer is the mind, thought. So, the yogi from there goes on to the purification of thoughts, the thinking process. The Germans don't believe that we have a thing called mind, but according to their language, they call it a Denk instrument. which means you call it the mind, but it is merely a collection of thoughts or a thinking stuff. Then the attention is directed to where the thoughts come from. That is the mind. Where do the thoughts come from? That is the mind. It is here that the Yoga Sutras help us. In the Yoga Sutras, yoga is defined as yogas chitta vritti nirodaha. The mind is restless. And as long as the mind is restless, it is not possible to study it. In order to study it, you must steady it. And you cannot purify it if it is not steady, and you cannot study. But luckily for us, the very act of observation steadies the mind. It's something beautiful one has to experience this oneself. The moment you begin to observe one thought, a single thought, any thought, good thought, bad thought, and look for its own source, the mind steadies itself. Attention has got that power. You may counter this by saying, but my attention is not steady, that is a problem. That's a different problem. When you practice some asanas, pranayama, japa, meditation and all that, in order to purify the mind, what one really needs is tremendous attention and earnestness. The ability to look within, deep within, undeflected, choicelessly becoming aware of the source of thought, whether it is good or bad. And then it is possible for you to discover that bad thoughts or evil thoughts are called evil thoughts only because they seem to veil this truth and make it more difficult to focus one's attention upon the source of thought. Otherwise, thought is a thought. It doesn't matter whether it is a good thought or a bad thought. But what is usually considered a bad thought makes it more difficult for you to concentrate your mind and focus it upon the source of thought. The very act of looking, observing, clarifies the field, purifies the field. I don't know how many of us would wantonly cling to wicked and vicious thoughts. If we realize that they are wicked and vicious thoughts, negative and hurtful to ourselves, that is what happens when you observe the mind with undivided attention, undeflected attention. When this goes on, and as this goes on, there is still an observer, the ego left. Once the field is clear, that is, the mind is purified of all its draws, and we are able to study the mind and steady the mind, then the only thing that is left is that which we have called the ego, I. The attention that was observing the mind, that is the source of all thoughts, keenly, tremendous keenness, finds itself without anything more to observe. The mind is clear, transparent. Then what do you observe? Naturally, there is only one thing more to observe. What am I? Here is a body. Here is a body or the body. Living body, thinking body, thinking being. But who am I in this? When that question arises, you are in meditation. Not till then. When that question arises, you are in meditation. Not till then. From here on, it's only God's grace that can lead us further. But when the rubbish in all these levels have been cleared, then the divine becomes radiant, luminous, and enlightenment is near at hand. There is no problem from there. God's grace is not bestowed upon some and denied to some by a partial God. Grace is there, but it is our own psychic, psychological, and probably physical impurity that blocks the grace from being experienced. By the practice of yoga, this impurity is done away with. The mind, the body becomes healthy again. The mind becomes steady and transparent, and in that transparent mind the light of God shines, dispelling what we had taken for granted as an existent principle called the ego. That is also realized as a dirt, as a piece of dirt. The ego is also considered, realized as a piece of dirt, and it disappears. That is enlightenment, or what is? What you are even now. It is not something which you are going to acquire from somewhere. That is what you are even now. That light, that divine, you are even now. There is a false idea that it is not so, and that is got rid of by the practice of yoga in all its aspects. Thank you.
Anyone like to ask any questions?
All clear.
Thank you very much, Swami.